If you love the show and feel like you always learn something new and it gets your mind going, then don't forget to become a patron. Patreon.com/VenusRoots. Alright, let's get into it. Everyone, you are tuned in for another episode of Getting to the Root of It with Venus Roots, aka me, your host. And today's guest, I'm really excited to get into conversation because I think he'll give us a lot of clarity and grounding on a really historic election. And it's actually not the US election that I'm referring to. I'm referring to Mexico's largest election in history that's happening in just a month. Today's guest is Kurt Hagbart, who's a writer for Jacobin and also the host of Soberania, the Mexican politics podcast. Thanks for being on the show, Kurt.
Hi, Nikki. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So there's so much happening, right? And you're on the ground. So I kind of want to just hear so many of your perspectives on this historic election and how the mood is feeling over there in Mexico. But I think we can start off with a little bit of grounding. You know, it's been, for me, it's been really amazing to sort of observe this new administration, AMLO's administration, kind of, you know, pivot from this sort of really neo-colonial rule that had been, you know, determining Mexico's reality for so long. And it's been a really exciting sort of administration to see from afar. But I'm curious if you could sort of situate us a little bit on like AMLO's campaign, his administration, and then we'll work our way to like where we're at now and what's next.
Yeah, sure. So as you said, it is an exciting time in Mexico. And, you know, I think it's a really underreported phenomenon in the United States and the Anglophone world in general. So I think it's really great that we're having this talk today. Andrés Manuel López Obrador is the president of Mexico now, and he won a historic victory in 2018. There's 6-year terms in Mexico with a brand new political party called Morena. Morena stands for Movimiento de Regeneración Nacional, which means National Regeneration Movement. We can talk a little bit more about the implications of that in a bit. But it's also very cleverly an acronym for a dark-skinned woman, right? A morena. And that's important when you just talked about this idea of a decolonial idea, really putting Mexico's poor and underclasses front and center. This was AMLO's third presidential campaign. He was cheated out of one in 2006. And then in 2012, his candidate literally bought votes with debit cards and all kinds of things. So this was the third time this was a charm election for AMLO in 2018. But his slogan has been consistent over these three campaigns: for the good of all, the poor must come first. And that's, you know, that's imbued with liberation theology, which was big in his youth. You know, AMLO was a college student, a freshman college student in 1973, right when Salvador Allende was overthrown by a U.S.-supported coup in Chile. So big dilemma for his generation of the left across Latin America has been, how can we win, first of all, and not get overthrown by a coup, second of all? So that's always been front and center for López Obrador. He was, you know, heading the pro-democracy movements in the late 80s and the early 90s, when the cracks in the PRI began to show. This was the hegemonic party that governed Mexico for 73 years. You know, he was in that fight, marching on Mexico City, camping in the Zocalo, in the main square. He eventually won the mayorship of Mexico City in 2000, and that was his springboard to national acclaim. His government over these 5.5 years has been, you know, a progressive center-left government. And that includes basically founding a Mexican welfare state, right? And that includes a universal pension, that includes scholarships for students, a disability pension, aid to single mothers, that includes union reform to allow for single secret ballot elections for unions, a restricting on outsourcing, infrastructure projects, health reforms, and also placing front and center the idea of Mexico as a sovereign nation, which is very, very important. That's why our podcast is called Sovereignty. Because the previous governments in Mexico, you know, stretching back 30 years and more, had been U.S. lapdogs. That includes restricting, you know, the actions of foreign intelligence agencies on Mexican soil. That meant sending a plane to rescue Evo Morales after the coup in Bolivia in 2019, calling a coup in Peru, not recognizing Guaido in Venezuela and calling him out for the sham that he was, and kind of reasserting Mexico's kind of historic role as the big brother in Latin America, you know, as one of the largest economies and one of the largest populations in Latin America, and kind of a buffer between, geographically and otherwise, between the United States and the rest of Latin America. You know, when the Summit of the Americas came up last year, AMLO said he wasn't going to go, you know, if all countries weren't invited, and sat it out, right? Much to the fuming of the State Department. So we can kind of go into more detail, but it's really been exciting, you know, supposedly now that the far right is on the march across Europe, plus the United States, we know what, you know, situation the U.S. is in. And also, you know, in Argentina, Chile looks set to elect a right-wing candidate next time. We see what's going on in Ecuador. So, you know, after a generation of neoliberal rule, you know, and with the far right on the march, I think what's happening in Mexico is all the more important, that not only did it win with a new party, Morena was just 4 years old when it won the presidency in 2018 and the Congress and the majority of the state houses. But it looks like, save a meteorite strike, that Morena is going to win again in a landslide in a month's time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Kurt, so much of what you just laid out, you know, I remember reading when AMLO decided to nationalize lithium, right? And then in addition to so many other things that you just mentioned, all of these are actions that will upset the United States, right? And, you know, you mentioned Salvador Allende, and there's a long history of that's documented, very well documented, of what the U.S. and the West will do in retaliation when countries try to act sovereign, try to assert right. their self-determination, right? And we see that with so many corners, right? We can look at Cuba, we can look at Haiti, et cetera, et cetera. Which I think makes Mexico really interesting right now, because there's been, you know, you wrote about this in Jacobin, and I know you've talked a lot about it, but this sort of smear campaign to, like, delegitimize AMLO and the Morena party and the administration, and sort of, you know, do the typical things of delegitimize and try to call fraud. Yeah. And, you know, can you talk a little bit about the smear campaign? Who are the big actors behind this? What is their sort of motive and interest in, you know, calling him narco presidente, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so I've covered the atrocious coverage of Mexico over the last 5 years by the U.S. press, and it's across the board. You know, it's not just right-wing press, you know, Fox, Breitbart, and whatever else. It's also, you know, the standard legacy press, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, NPR, just across the board. And it's a mixture of ignorance on Mexico, a lack of curiosity as to what's going on, and, you know, out and out, you know, racism, this idea that nothing can happen in Mexico except, you know, violence and squalor. And so to see past that to a transformation that's going on in the country. And we can't forget the U.S. press is the soft power arm of imperialism. That's crucial. And so we'll give you an example, just the example that you brought up, this narco presidente bit. At the beginning of the year, you know, we're heading into an election year, both in the U.S. and Mexico, right? At the beginning of the year, the Baker Institute, which is part of Rice University in Houston, and it's basically a nexus of international energy interests. And let's keep in mind that one of AMLO's big sovereignty moves over his presidency has been to take more control over Mexico's energy sector. You mentioned the nationalization of lithium. He's also worked to strengthen Mexico's public energy agency, the CIFE, the Comisión Federal de Electricidad, and, you know, take back power from multinationals like Iberdrola in Spain or Enel from Italy, who were cannibalizing Mexico's energy grid for their own purposes. So that's been a big fight, which has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. So you have the Baker Institute, which is the nexus of international energy interests. All of a sudden, their Mexico report for 2024 come out and say, Morena and organized crime may very well be in cahoots in this election because they have aligned interests. No evidence, nothing to back this up. They just, you know, plop it into their report, and it has the backing of a U.S. university, which is Rice University. This is how, you know, this combination of universities and think tanks and supposedly nonpartisan academic institutes generate news out of nothing, generate, you know, stories. So then the head of the, you know, the Mexico Institute at Baker, Tony Payan, gives an interview to the Texas Observer, nominally a progressive outlet, the Texas Observer, which just repeats verbatim what he says without no pushback, no questioning. Oh, okay, Morena and the narco are going to be together in this election. So when the Texas Observer publishes it, that gives carte blanche to the Mexican press to say the U.S. determines that there will be, you know, narco-Morena alliance in the next election. And it jumps into the Mexican press and it starts spreading like a virus. Now, that's step one. Step two, you know, a couple weeks later, a coordinated series of hits come out in ProPublica, in Inside Crime, in Deutsche Welle, all on the same day. How funny, three pieces on the same day, which say that there was drug money. There's an attempt by the narcos to give money in AMLO's first presidential campaign in 2006. So they dredged up a closed investigation from 15 or so years ago, which never went anywhere, and added nothing new to it to suggest that, oh, well, this isn't just now. It was also back then in AMLO's first campaign in 2006, based on, you know, an unreliable witness. And it was very clear that this was coming right out of the DEA. Why is it coming out of the DEA? Because the DEA didn't like AMLO's national security law of a couple of years ago, which limits their actions on Mexican soil. They want, you know, the green light to be able to come down here, shoot them up, do what they want, you know, play their drug war game and try to, you know, protect their turf. We can also talk later about how corrupt the DEA is internally, because the U.S. press never discusses that part. So that's step two. And of course, it got a lot of blowback, the ProPublica piece, because it, you know, it dredged up something that had never gone anywhere in the first place. So the editor of ProPublica, Steve Engelberg, had to come out and defend the piece. And by doing so, admits that the DEA was trying to set up AMLO's campaign, the second campaign in 2012, with a $5 million sting operation. They were trying to fabricate a crime. While the government in power at that time of Felipe Calderon was, you know, in cahoots with Sinaloa cartel, right, with Genaro García Luna, the security minister who's been convicted in a Brooklyn court. The DEA was trying to set AMLO up, his campaign. Anyway, not to go into too much detail there, but step three, the New York Times then comes out with its own piece a few weeks later, saying that there was attempts to infiltrate AMLO's 2018 campaign with drug money. Again, no evidence, no proof, all hearsay, you know, really just malpractice of journalism. And that's Natalie Kitcheroff there, who is the New York Times correspondent in Mexico City. And AMLO called this stuff out at his morning press conference. Right? Just he called it out, which I think is one of the kind of the interesting ways AMLO has had to hit back on these hit pieces. He has a morning press conference that sometimes goes for 2 or 3 hours a day and calls this stuff out and says, you know, this is a violation of sovereignty. It's, you know, we're not, you know, basically we're not going to put up with this stuff anymore. And, you know, as if that weren't enough, then there was a huge social media campaign calling AMLO Narco Presidente, Narco Claudia. Claudia Sheinbaum is the presidential candidate now. Narco this, narco that. Basically, anyone progressive in Latin America is a narco, right? This is the way you can just tar anyone. Right? Well, we saw an Ecuador campaign in 2023. They've used it against Evo Morales. You know, long list of et cetera. Anyone the U.S. doesn't like is a narco. Right? But interestingly enough, the hashtag campaign, there were spelling errors in the campaign, Narco President instead of Narco Presidente and a bunch of other things. They were just, they weren't careful. So that allowed people to trace where these bot farms and troll farms were coming from Argentina, from Colombia, from Spain. A lot of money behind it, a lot of money behind it. To make a long story short, and it's a happy ending, at least in this case, AMLO's approval rating went up 10 points over this period. The Mexican public is, you know, politicized, it's aware, and it's sick of all of these hits coming from the U.S. And we see now a boomerang effect of these hits actually increasing AMLO's popularity rather than otherwise.
It's funny because... you know, it kind of had the complete adverse effect. But I, you know, something that's really troubling about all of this is it's so patronizing, right? That the U.S. sort of gives itself the authority to, yeah, just kind of pinpoint so-and-so is a narco and just make up these lies and just fabricate it. And I think, you know, related... But different is, I think this moment around Palestine has really awakened a lot of people in the West to really question the legitimacy of these so-called media outlets, these so-called journalists, and to your earlier point, really see them more of as a soft arm of imperial interest, of war manufacturers, of, you know, private capital, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, back to Mexico, I think it's seeing how, like, a year and some ago at this point, hearing, like, Republican senators suggest that because of the narco situation and, of course, related to AMLO, that the U.S. should be able to invade. And just saying this flippantly and candidly was really disturbing. I remember being in Mexico a couple months after that and just talking to people. And, yeah, I think people just being, like, you know, what the hell is that? Who gets to do that and just sort of make these, like, blanket threats? Can you talk a little bit also, and of course it's a bipartisan effort, but can you talk a little bit about the sort of, you know, the smear campaign is, it precedes just January, this moment, and it just precedes right now election season, but other sort of tactics and other things that you've been noticing the West and the U.S., try to do to target AMLO in these past 6 years that really stand out to you?
Yeah. Just a quick point, what you were mentioning about Palestine, I think you're absolutely right. This has really been a moment of real awakening as to how the U.S. media rolls and what its agenda is and how, you know, capable it is of either lying by omission, by leaving stuff out, or lying by commission, straight out lying, right? We see it with, you know, the New York Times and Anat Schwartz and that whole scandal that's come up over there. You know, what the New York Times is doing with regards to Mexico and Latin American coverage is no better, right? They just out and out lie when they need to, or are they just, you know, twist and omit and all of their bag of tricks, right? And it's really interesting, too, that just last week, the State Department came out with its, you know, its human rights report, because the United States considers itself that it's in the position to qualify the human rights in other parts of the world. And of course, it expressed its concern over the human rights situation in Mexico. So Mexicans are seeing the State Department qualifying their human rights situation while, you know, they're beating the crap out of students in the United States right now, and professors and other people. It's such a bald distinction, you know, that the United States on one hand is lecturing about human rights and doing what it's doing right now in front of our eyes on college campuses everywhere, as if the rest of the world doesn't see that. So with regards to the point about this idea of invasion, that's just the extension of U.S. hubris. You know, on one hand, we can qualify your human rights. And on the other hand, we'll weaponize human rights as an excuse to invade if necessary. And, you know, you see Dan Crenshaw, you know, Lindsey Graham openly trying to get an authorization for the use of military force, right? With no pushback from the Democrats whatsoever, or very little, you know, very little. And so what was a totally marginal idea a few years ago has now become mainstream. This idea of invading Mexico, that's now in the Trump platform. Part of the Trump platform is massive sweeps against immigrants, setting up basically concentration camps, mass deportations, and also, you know, overt and covert operations against Mexico on Mexican soil. Right? So I wrote a piece in Jacobin a few months ago about how that could actually play out if the U.S. tried to do that. It would be a real, I mean, it would just be, you know, a tenfold tragedy over the tragedy that's already happening on the border. You know, that would entail, as the U.S. always does, bombing innocent people, bombing schools, bombing hospitals, and claiming they had to get at cartels, you know, which were using people as human shields. It would entail massive migration flows, you know, X number of times more than is happening now. And it would mean cartel retaliation against, you know, U.S. troops and probably against the civil population within the United States. So, it would be spreading the issue farther into the U.S., which is where the problem is anyway, because that's where the drug consumption is. I painted a scenario where maquiladora factory workers walk out of their jobs, the border is sealed. You know, Mexico is now the U.S.'s number one trading partner. You know, it's surpassed China. So what would happen to supply chains within the U.S. if, you know, parts couldn't get back and forth? The U.S. would fall into a recession or worse. Mexico would fall into a recession or worse. It would be dystopian, you know, and, you know, you get to the point where if you have these massive immigration flows going across the border and you've got the Texas National Guard or whatever that decides to open fire, it could be a bloodbath. I think all this is still fairly unlikely, but, you know, if Republicans are openly talking about invading Mexico, then we should talk about what that would entail, right? Because everybody thinks it's like a video game, right? But, you know, the United States was in Afghanistan for 20 years and had to, you know, run with its tail between its legs. It was in Iraq, got kicked out. You know, Libya, what's happening in Ukraine now? And now they want to ramp up the Pacific with Taiwan and invade Mexico at the same time. I mean, it's just, it seems like it's a country that's out of control. It really seems like it's out of control. Doesn't know how to stop.
Completely. Mm-hmm. Completely. No, and I really appreciate this sort of, like the envisioning, because I think you're right. I think we, especially I think us in this country, in the U.S., are so accustomed to hearing these sort of blanket threats of invasion, of bombing, of, you know, of conquer, that I think it's hard for us in the day-to-day to actually visualize what that actually would mean, what that actually would entail. And it is disturbing to see that, you know, it's not just Republican senators, it's not just Republican politicians that have contributed to the sort of delegitimizing of Mexico's government, Mexico's decision to, you know, want to be a sovereign nation.
Yeah.
I think a couple of weeks ago, maybe it was, I watched AMLO's interview on 60 Minutes. And, you know, it was a funny interview in some ways. One of the things I like about his charisma is, you know, he's very blunt. And you mentioned earlier how he called out the New York Times so-called journalist who was, you know, linking his campaign to narcotraficantes and stuff. But, you know, he's very blunt and very direct and very much says it how it is, and which I don't think a lot of politicians do, not in an honest way. And in that interview, he talks about the sort of responsibility that the U.S. has to Mexico. You know, I think he mentions the U.S. sort of owing Mexico $20 billion. And if I understood correctly, and he also mentions the sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba in the 60 Minutes as sort of things to consider for the U.S. to actually be in better relationship with Mexico. Can you talk a little bit about that? What did you gather from that? What are you sort of gathering around this new government, and, you know, if Morena wins again, what's possible for other Latin American countries and what's possible for the region in terms of collaboration and support?
That's a really good question. So let's start with 60 Minutes, which was an interesting interview. And it's interesting because, first of all, you know, 60 Minutes, you know, only broadcast 12 to 13 minutes of a one-hour interview. And so what AMLO did is he recorded it himself, released here in Mexico the full hour, which is really interesting, right? And this is what I mean. He's a very clever politician. Knowing that, you know, 60 Minutes was very likely going to edit and probably edit out some of the more interesting parts, he said, all right, I'll record it, you know, also, and then put the full hour up for people to see, right? This is part of his idea, lo público cada vez más público, right? Things that are public should be increasingly public, right? Enough of democracy behind closed doors. And I think part of that edited, a part he went really after the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, for his racist comments about Mexico. And there's a bunch of other goodies in there. But with regards to the plan that you mentioned, this is Latin America talking, and this is, again, this idea of Mexico as the big brother. I'm not going to say speaking for Latin America, because every country speaks for themselves. You know, that would be, you know, arrogant to say, but Mexico being a regional advocate. What he said was, you know, you want to tackle immigration, let's attack the root causes of immigration. Right. And so that's why part of his social programs over his administration have been an apprenticeship program where students who are either not studying or don't have jobs can get apprenticeships in businesses with government support. You know, it's the so-called ninis, right? Ni trabaja ni estudia. Right. Sembrando Vida, which is a tree planting program and an environmental program. Going after in other social programs that I've mentioned. So what he wants to do is extend those programs to Central America, and that's why he asked for that $20 billion from the U.S., which is so nothing. You know, I mean, that's chump change for the U.S., considering the $900 billion a year defense budget, considering they just kicked $60 billion more to Ukraine and $25 billion more to Israel with, you know, they just rammed that through Congress. But for Latin America, that would be, that would just be impossible, right? Because it's like, oh, giving money away, you know, to this U.S. mentality. They can throw money elsewhere, but not to Latin America unless they're for arms or security or more police or more militarization, because that's the U.S.'s only paradigm. That's their only way of seeing the world. So his four-point plan on 60 Minutes was the social programs for Central America, ending the embargo on Cuba, ending the sanctions on Venezuela, and legalizing Mexicans who've been 5 or more years in the U.S., you know, in good standing. Kind of an extension of the Dreamer idea. So this is an idea that's designed to get at some of the causes of things, right? I mean, we can't get around that the U.S. has caused its own immigration problem by, you know, embargoes, by sanctions, by coups, by destabilization. You know, on one hand, the United States says it's against immigration. On the other hand, it's done everything possible to create the conditions for immigration across. So the idea was to start that conversation. And it's funny that after that interview, I looked at the 60 Minutes social media, you know, Twitter and Facebook, where they published the clips, and just the response from the U.S. public. And, you know, 60 Minutes is hardly a far right program. You know, it's not a fire breathing right wing program. It's kind of a standard center staid Sunday night kind of program. The response, people were livid. AMLO is blackmailing the United States. This is blackmail. He's saying if you don't give us money, that he's going to let the immigrants come through. This is repeated in comment after comment. Blackmail, 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 right? Bomb Mexico, invade Mexico, coup AMLO. There was a gift for a nuclear bomb. I mean, the United States is unhinged when you see. Now, the social media is not representative of the country as a whole. I don't claim to say that. But, you know, 60 Minutes is supposedly a fairly calm kind of program compared to some of the other ones. And people are just off the map that a Mexican president would attempt to make a counterproposal on immigration rather than just accepting the United States dictates on this and doing whatever, you know, Biden or whomever says. And I thought that was very instructive, because I think the United States is very not prepared for this conversation about facing up to historical responsibilities and not doing things that aggravate the very problem they pretend to be concerned about. Because I think what the United States really wants is it wants both things, right? It wants cheap illegal labor, but, you know, it doesn't want, big migration flows either. So it's always played both ends of the argument against each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's quite wild. Yeah, I saw some of the articles that came out in response to it, and, you know, I think one of them, of course, was Fox News, and, you know, Trump responding to that statement and saying that, I think he said he wouldn't give him 10 cents. Trump wouldn't give AMLO 10 cents. And yeah, just this constant blackmail. And it's also what the interviewer herself in the sort of edited version, that's sort of, yeah, that's the language she uses. She says, you know, isn't this political blackmail? And just as you said, you know, AMLO just reaffirms that this is actually just a historical truth that, you know, now we're living in the consequences of and have to solve. I'm also, you know, I kind of want to switch gears a bit, because I think thinking ahead to sort of possibility and what is continuing to change in the region and, you know, in different directions, right? There is this growing sort of like neo-fascism, you know, right-wing wave happening all over the world, including Latin America, as you mentioned at the top of the show. But there is also, you know, on the other side, there's also possibility for more deepening solidarity between countries in the region, especially now with Mexico in this position. So switching gears a bit, I mean, what do you, being on the ground, like, what is exciting people in Mexico about the Morena campaign this go around? Like, what are the highlights? What are people sort of gravitating towards this go around?
I think the first thing to kind of paint a picture for a U.S. audience is that Morena is a mass party. You know, the U.S. has become so depoliticized in terms of party politics. The U.S. is very politicized with regards to other things, right? Black Lives Matter, trade unionism, the resurgent trade movement, the students. But, you know, party politics, my God, you know, if there were Democrats and the Republicans, between them could get 50 people out, it would be a lot, right? Morena is a mass party. And that's really something to see. I was up in Mexico City for the Morena campaign, presidential campaign kickoff on March 1st. And, you know, there were 350,000 people there from all over the country for the kickoff, an estimated 350,000 people. So when it comes to town, it's a big thing. You know, Mexico City is, I think, the second biggest, one of the world's biggest cities after Tokyo, right? It's a big city. But when there's a Morena rally, the whole historic center becomes, you know, pedestrianized. Traffic shuts down, public transportation shuts down because it's full of a crush of people. You know, bands playing on the street and people dancing and, you know, people on stilts, Sanka, you know, there's this idea that we've lost in the U.S. I guess there was a glimmer of that with Bernie, that politics can be mass politics and it can also be fun. You know? And Morena has that. Now, Morena has its internal problems, you know, which, you know, I think we could devote another whole, you know, a program to, because, you know, the internal dynamics at any party is always going to be, you know, how you choose the candidates and, you know, the platform. There's always going to be, you know, Morena's a young party that's still feeling out its legs. So, but there's an excitement, you know, that this transformation has, you know, kicked out a real neoliberal kleptocracy that was running the country into the ground, very literally, up to 2018. I mean, really, really, really running it into the ground. So there's an excitement around that. You know, last year at the rally celebrating the history of Mexico's oil expropriation in 1938 and the nationalization of lithium, there were even more people. There was like 500,000, they said. So I guess the idea of mass politics is one thing. The idea that it's going to be, you know, with near certainty, Mexico's first woman president, and Claudia Sheinbaum. You know? Claudia Sheinbaum was a borough chief in Mexico City, and then the mayor of Mexico City, really governor, because Mexico City is a state, technically. And, you know, her idea is to put the segundo piso of the transformation, right? The segundo piso, the second floor. So that includes building public housing. That includes continuing to increase the minimum wage, which has gone up 100%. That includes, you know, energy transition. She's in climate change and environmental engineers. So that's really her area. That includes raising the social programs to a constitutional level so they can't be, you know, taken away later. Addressing Mexico's water issues. A focus on community centers in arts and sports, lowering the pension age, which is now at 65, to 60 for women who would get half a pension at that age, you know, knowing that a lot of times women are caregivers and haven't been in, you know, salaried jobs where you can accumulate a pension, you know. A focus on women's issues, which is, you know, obviously carried over from her time as mayor of Mexico City, right? So it's, you know, in one sense, she's the continuity candidate. And the right wing tries to say, oh, well, she's just going to be a puppet of AMLO. Right. Just silly stuff like that. There was just a Bloomberg podcast the other day. She's like, oh, she's going to be like Medvedev to Putin, right? The guy who was president for a term and Putin was, you know, pulling the strings behind the scenes. Just silly, silly nonsense you get from the U.S. press that just can't, you know, can't give Mexico agency, can't give Morena agency, and could never give Claudia Sheinbaum agency, right? And there's this idea in the U.S. that every candidate has to be, you know, shiny new, like a new project, like a new detergent. And what Claudia Sheinbaum says is, no, we're building a segundo piso. I'm proud of what we did with López Obrador. I'm proud of what Morena is doing. We're going to build on that. We're going to build on those programs and extend them, right? So I think it's extending this to areas that hasn't had as much attention in the first term, because you can't do everything in 6 years, right? So that's part of it, right? And Sheinbaum's also benefited from a terrible right-wing candidate who's just committed gaffe after gaffe after gaffe. So her lead now is, you know, 20, 25 points in the polls, which is why I said that save a meteorite strike, Morena's going to win, which is why, you know, the right wing, you know, and it's their foreign allies are focusing on the post-electoral phase. And they're saying, okay, we're not going to win, but maybe we can find some kind of legal loophole to annul the election. You know, AMLO violated presidential neutrality during the campaign, or it's an election of state where, you know, AMLO tipped the scale in Sheinbaum's favor, and we're going to try to annul the election that way. Kind of this desperate attempt to kind of find some kind of legal mechanism to annul the election. So I think really we have to be, you know, have our eyes on the election, but also really have our eyes on the post-election, because you're going to hear this drumbeat from the U.S. press, right? The narco president put his thumb on the scale and installed and imposed his own hand-picked successor and blah, 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 right? And so they'll try to, you know, invalidate or at least tarnish the election that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that feels right. And I appreciate, because, you know, my next question was going to be,
oh, good.
What should we be vigilant of, you know, and you sort of got to that of, you know, I think to your point, you know, the right is always working backwards, you know, and they're sort of thinking of all the moving pieces. And I think sometimes we on the left are, you know, we're maybe waiting for the win. But to your point, there'll be so many strategic and calculated moves that happen after Morena wins. But it sounds really energizing. It sounds so exciting to hear that this is happening in Mexico. And, you know, I think for me, because sometimes I think maybe talking to people, it's like, well, okay, that's great, but like, what does it have to, you know, what's at stake for me here, or what's at stake besides beyond Mexico? But I think so much of what we touched on really illuminate this sort of Latin American solidarity that I think is more important than ever. I think the region sort of solidifying its bonds against Western imperialism is going to be really important in these coming decades. I think, you know, it's something that I also think a lot of people don't know is that AMLO's also leaving office with a super, super high favorable rating amongst the Mexican people, even in the backdrop of all this U.S. media press attacks and nonsense. Can you speak a little bit to that, of just kind of like also his reputation and how he's sort of closing out his 6-year term in terms of, yeah, reputation and impact?
Yeah, so one thing to mention is that AMLO is term limited to one term. And that's a fundamental part of the Mexican Constitution going back to the Mexican Revolution, right? Because there was a 19th century dictator called Porfirio Diaz back in the late 19th and early 20th century, who reelected himself, I think, five times. So the big rallying cry of the Mexican Revolution was no reelection. And so that's why Mexican presidents can't be reelected. And it's funny that the right wing the whole time said, AMLO's going to change the constitution to reelect himself. And AMLO, no. And they're like, yes, he is. He's like, no. And so now they've just pivoted to saying, oh, well, he's just going to be the power behind the throne to Sheinbaum. It's like they can never admit they were wrong. They can never admit they were wrong because they were so certain that AMLO was, you know, the dictator. Because this is the only paradigm they have, right? The messianic, populist, Latin American, you know, dictator, right? The charismatic leader who, you know, uses his magnetic power to beguile these ignorant, you know, masses. Because this is the only paradigm they have to think about. It's the only, this is the only image they have. And when AMLO didn't live up to that, all they did was pivot, right? And it's also, this is the idea that AMLO is authoritarian, right? But at the same time, he's too soft, right? Because they constantly mention this hugs, not bullets thing, right? AMLO in the 2018 campaign, one of his, you know, slogans was abrazos, no balazos. What he meant by that was addressing the root causes of crime so that young people aren't going to be, you know, easy fodder for organized crime and delinquency, right? So the U.S. press has picked up on that and actually literally thinks that AMLO wants to hug criminals or wants people to hug criminals. This is how dumb and literalizing they are. So on one hand, he's a dictator. On the other hand, he's hugging organizing criminals, right? So make up your mind. Right, basically. The legacy of AMLO has been an important one, you know, with, you know, all of his flaws that any leader has. He's been truly the only figure that could break through this kleptocracy that I was mentioning before, this neoliberal kleptocracy that was, you know, that ran the country for decades. Really, Mexico hasn't had a left-wing president, arguably, since Lázaro Cárdenas in the 1930s. And since the 1930s. So, you know, Mexico has been hurt, right? There was a massive devaluation in 1982, right? There was another massive devaluation in 1994, which wiped out people's savings. There's been this drug war, which Felipe Calderón launched in 2006, you know, on U.S. bidding, of course, which has devastated the social fabric of the country. Right? Just devastated it. Well over 100,000 killed in that. Mexico is still a graveyard. It's littered with common graves that still haven't been found. NAFTA and all of the, you know, effects and the consequences of the free trade agreement, you know, which dumped agribusiness, U.S. agribusiness products on there into the Mexican market and, you know, led to an abandonment of farming because you couldn't compete with U.S. agribusiness and, you know, flooded the Mexican market with sugary drinks and fattening foods and led to an obesity and a diabetes epidemic in Mexico. You know, if we talk about the shock doctrine, the Mexican public has been through a hell of a lot of shocks. That's just four right there. Two major devaluations, NAFTA and the drug war, right? And through all of that, they've managed to create a nonviolent movement that took control of the presidency and the Congress in 2018, despite all odds. So it's been a real shot on the arm. It's been a real shot in the arm. And the fact that, you know, it's very likely to continue. That's very important because there's a lot left to do. You know, the right wing in Mexico is very, it's using the judicial branch as its trench there. You know, where just like the U.S. Supreme Court, the Mexican Supreme Court is, you know, throwing out laws left and right with its conservative majority, throwing out this on technicalities. Mexico's energy reform, Mexico's electoral reform, and this and that, right? So it's been a heady time. And I think going back to your question, you know, what is this, you know, people in the U.S. asking, what does this have to do with me? I think there's a lot it has to do because, you know, the U.S. left is not in its best moment. You know, it's not. And I think we have to admit that and say maybe we can find some lessons from other countries. Not everything will be applicable because they're different cultures and different histories. But I think we have to be humble enough on the U.S. left to learn lessons, right? And one lesson is how AMLO has managed to not get rolled by the press, right? Like Sanders, like Corbyn, like, you know, Pablo Iglesias in Spain, like a host of, you know, like Dilma Rousseff, like, you know, Lula, who was imprisoned, all the lawfare that's going on across Latin America, how AMLO has managed not to get rolled by the press. We can learn from that. You know, how AMLO, you know, has managed to, and Morena has managed to get the working class on side. You know, it's funny that if you compare the voting data from 2018 to 2021, you know, in other countries, there's been a de-alignment, what they call de-alignment, where the working classes have abandoned left-wing parties because they've abandoned them. What you see is kind of a certain extent, a realignment in Mexico, where the rich are now voting more for the right wing and the working class are voting, kind of come home to voting more for Morena. For now, you know, that's subject to change, but for now, there's been a degree of realignment in Mexican politics. You know, the Democrats have long since abandoned the U.S. working class. So what can we learn? You know, what, raising the minimum wage, union reform, outsourcing reform. These are things that speak to, you know, pension reform. These are things that speak to working class voters, which the Democrats have long since lost communication with. So, you know, this idea of mass politics again, you know, and not just because there's a charismatic candidate, but mass party politics. So I think there are some things to learn here, you know, and I think Mexico is on one hand so close to the U.S., you know, so close that we think, oh, we know everything about it. But on the other hand, I think the average American knows so very little about Mexico, really. So very little. And I think there's be a real chance for some cross-border solidarity with regards to union workers and the independent union movement, for example, in Mexico that's happening now. And with regards to a lot of other issues, women's issues, indigenous issues, so many things. If we had further channels of communication, you know, there are 40 million people of Mexican descent in the U.S., of first, second, and third generation. 40 million people. That's a country. That's a country right there. What's the engagement with the Mexican community? What's the engagement with Mexican political movements? Right? You know, so much is heard about the Cuban American community, but what about the much larger Mexican American community? The much, much larger. And a much more progressive, generally, community, because they are all, you know, poor and working class people who had to abandon Mexico because of, you know, decades of neoliberal and right-wing politics. So I think there's a lot of potential there, in short. Kind of a long-winded answer, but kind of I think there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah. Kurt, thank you so much for this. I'm feeling really just, like, energized from hearing all of this laid out. I think, you know, it's a really particular time in history. This is a conjuncture that has, you know, been in the making for so long, but also in some ways feels so unexpected. You know, what, like, after this, I'm heading to an encampment at one of the universities in New York City, and seeing all of these connections of anti-imperialist movements, anti-imperialist advocacies, gaining more and more popularity across the world, feel incredibly enlivening, and super appreciative for you taking time to talk to me today and just all the history and all the context, and super excited to see what happens on June 2nd.
Yeah, we'll be there in Mexico City. So it's it'll be an exciting night.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show, Kurt. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.